James Clifford Leach and Claude Sawyer Fox, my grandfathers, were two very different men. My paternal grandfather, Tippy, was a big, gregarious man with an engaging personality, a loud laugh, and a stubborn assumption that everyone welcomed hearing his opinions. From Tippy, I got my love of baseball and a strong dose of obstinacy. My maternal grandfather, Papa, was more of a still waters running deep kind of person. Steady, calm, deeply introspective, with all of his churn on the inside. From Papa, I got my love of nature, my capacity for wonder, and a delight in language. For all of their obvious variances, they shared certain qualities, none more apparent than their capacities to tell a story. They were both engaging raconteurs. Tippy recounting seeing my grandmother descending a stairway at the University of Georgia and knowing that he would marry her, even though they hadn't actually met. Papa quietly unveiling the account of packing the wooden trunk now at the foot of our bed and boarding a train for college, the first and only in his family to do so. From both of them, I got a love of stories, a way of often thinking of things in terms of a narrative and a tendency to contextualize facts in a certain loquacious, some might rightly say rambling way of communicating. It often feels a bit inelegant to me to spill the beans too quickly. Why rush to the factual destination when we can enjoy a narrative journey along the way? That's one of the things that attracted me to ministry. Religion is rarely conveyed in brief declarations or terse definitions. Originating in that time when our primordial forebears first began to wonder, religion has most often been passed along in multivalent myths, narratives, parables, stories of one kind and another. It was in the church of my childhood and adolescence that I heard the best, most imaginative, truly unbelievable stories of all. So when in my study of philosophy, I came across John S. Donne's core question in the very first sentence of the preface to his book, Time and Myth, it made a great deal of sense to me. Donne asks, what kind of story are we in? What kind of story are we in? While some gravitate to the more impressive precision of business or law or science or music, my own core constitution, stoked by my beloved grandfathers, is to look for and find meaning as a narrative, as a story. So asking Donne's question rings true for me. What kind of story are we in? For most of my adult life, I've had not so much an answer as a response. I've been convinced that a certain story makes sense. In fact, that it makes the most sense. It is a narrative tapestry made up of many different strands woven into a cogent description of how things are. For example, 19th century Unitarian James Freeman Clark's version of the story was encapsulated as the final part of what he called the theology of the future. Clark asserted with the unfettered optimism of classic late 19th century liberalism, that the story we are in is one of the, quote, continuity of human development in all worlds, or the progress of humankind onward and upward forever. Another strand comes in the form of James Milton's question, who ever knew truth put to the worse in a free and open encounter? A confidence echoed in Thomas Jefferson's assurance that truth will do well enough if left to shift for herself. Then there was the strand expressed in Dostoevsky's assertion, beauty will save the world. A belief amplified in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Nobel lecture, in which the great writer said that in the consummate truth and goodness of beauty, age-old violence will topple. It will topple in defeat. What kind of story are we in, woven together alongside similarly confident strands? I came to believe that bolstered by truth and beauty, the human story is one about development, progress on a trajectory that points onward and upward forever. Human progress is not only predictable, it is inevitable. Now, my own version of this story has been tempered by a not insignificant sense of the tragic. I have always wrestled with a certain pall, cast by an at times overly attentive awareness of all the ways life is unjust. While that also motivated me toward ministry, this deep sense of the tragic has made ministry harder on me and on others at times than perhaps it has needed to be. But the story persisted, and it was the story. So when I arrived here 15 years ago, it was one I told in one way and another. Not infrequently, I have appealed to a version of that story told first by our religious forebear Theodore Parker and then made more accessible by our national prophet gone for a full half century now, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You've heard me proclaim it. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Oh, the times, these times, any times, may be marked by pain and suffering, inequities and injustice, but take heart. Have faith. The arc will bend. It absolutely will bend toward justice. We will develop. We will progress. And at some point within or perhaps beyond our lifetimes, carried on the wings of truth and beauty, we will enter a time defined by peace, informed by justice. While often appealing to their essential metaphor, my personal faith in that story has been quite different from that of both Parker and King. Their confidence was underwritten by a belief in a God whose purposes, while mysterious, were at least known enough to assure us that God's ways will ultimately prevail. My own telling of that story has been rooted in another sort of faith. Mine has been faith in humankind. in the wonder of our remarkable species. That was why humanism, substantive, rational, positive humanism of a regrettably rare sort, finally paved the way for me to enter into Unitarian Universalism. I came here as your minister with that worldview intact, with a story to tell of the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice, because we humans have been and would continue bending it that way. So, for example, when early on I disclosed here the depth of my commitment to marriage equality and my conviction that I should not sign anyone's marriage license until I could sign everyone's marriage license, I did so declaring that the arc would bend. When we walked together through the valley of despair in those difficult days of Amendment 1, I was sustained by this story, believing that history would prove us right, as it has on that particular issue. That story provided a foundation as firm as one is ever going to feel for me. The currency of my convictions and commitment was backed by the gold standard of that story, making any and all investments of time and of energy worthy and worthwhile. After all, I am not acting alone in some naive, even foolish, futile tilt at windmills. I am acting in concert with the grand and inspiring way that things will be when the onward and upward trajectory of human progress at last intersects with the bending arc of the moral universe. My friends, I stand before you today deeply aware that the bold and beautiful tapestry that is this defining story, one that in so many ways has been the defining story of my ministry, began several years ago to fray. The harder I tried to mend it, the more it seemed to fray. I have no single factor to which I can point, no trauma, no tragedy so profound that my faith was lost. I experienced no one disappointment that caused me to reject a story in which I have been so deeply invested. But gradually, I began considering truly unsettling questions. What if James Freeman Clark told the wrong story? And there isn't continuity in human development. What if we don't necessarily progress onward and upward forever? What if Milton and Jefferson told the wrong story and truth isn't guaranteed to prevail? What if Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn told the wrong story and beauty won't save the world? What if Parker and King, for all of their faith, told the wrong story? And the arc of the moral universe doesn't bend toward justice. Whatever else contributed to my doubts, I began to suspect that privilege may have allowed me to see possibility where others saw only a recurring cycle of oppression. That privilege may have allowed me to see causes for hope where others saw only confirmation of their hope-deprived station in life. That privilege may have allowed me to continue to see what my own history and my own needs had for so long made me accustomed to see. What kind of story are we in? What if it is simply a cycle circling through the same sorts of injustices? What if it's a wildly undulating course in which mountaintops of accomplishment lead back down into valleys of setback and reversal? What if the arc bends downward? What if we're pointed not toward some beauty-filled denouement, but toward our ultimate demise? What kind of story are we in? I'd love to tell you that I've gotten this all worked out, that I've rewoven the tapestry, that I fixed its frays, and am now ready to pronounce again that we humans are headed onward and upward. But for this decade and a half, I've tried to be honest with you, to share the hope and the hurt authentically. I can't now cross my fingers and simply write off my own struggle. The truth is, I'm considerably more inclined to tell the story we heard earlier from Ta-Nehisi Coates. When considering Parker and King's claim about the Ark, Coates asserts, "That's just something I don't share." The sense of destiny that it will, I just don't share it. There's ample evidence that it might not. To quote Ta-Nehisi Coates, "That's where I come down." What then do I do? If my feeble, fallible efforts to contribute to the cause of justice aren't backed by some story of its eventual arrival, can I continue to listen and learn, build relationships, and following the lead of the most marginalized, act on behalf of the cause of justice? If progress isn't inevitable, is a long, long, long investment in transformation, at best a long shot gamble, and at worst the buying of the worthless junk bonds of self-deception. Shortly before my arrival here 15 years ago, I read something quite unlikely for me, to which I have returned again. It was, of all things, an article in The New Yorker about a 20th century economist named Frank Knight. Knight wrote about uncertainty in business decisions. Uncertainty doesn't have to lead to paralysis. The article explained Knight believed that businesses prosper only when their executives are willing to act in spite of it. Hunkering down is no more rational than acting boldly. That's a strand in a new story that I'm searching for a way to tell. Hunkering down is no more rational than acting boldly. If I'm honestly uncertain about whether the arc bends or not, then recoiling, pulling back, sitting it out makes no more sense than continuing to do what I believe makes some difference. Here, then, is where I am comforted by writer, filmmaker, activist Susan Sontag. The likeliness that your acts of resistance cannot stop the injustice. The likelihood that your acts of resistance cannot stop the injustice does not exempt you, she declared, from acting in what you sincerely and reflectively hold to be the best interest of your community. Even if the odds are long, continuing to act is advisable, maybe even imperative. That's a strand in a news story I'm searching for a way to tell. And then, as a latecomer to the writings of Rebecca Solnit, I'm taking solace in her admission. Hope, she says, doesn't mean denying difficult realities. Hope, she says, is not the belief that everything was, is, or will be fine. Hope, she says, locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. That's a strand in a new story I'm searching for a way to tell. What an honor earlier this year to welcome Bree Newsom to this pulpit. In an article for the momentous new Atlantic Monthly retrospective on the life and legacy of Dr. King, Bree writes this: "In my current work as a community organizer in North Carolina, the other activists and I operate by a principle we refer to as seven generations. The concept, which we adapted from the Iroquois Confederacy, means we understand that the work we're doing has gone on for seven generations and will continue for seven more." So Bree writes, "The movement lives because of the many people, places, and generations that breathe life into it." Oh, I need that strand. I need that strand in my new story as well. So, frayed worldview and all, I'm continuing to listen, learn, build relationships, and act. I'm doing so while still grieving the loss of the story that guided me. It was easier when I imagined an eventual outcome. But I also recognize with ever clearer clarity that despair is an option only for the privileged. For if enough is at stake, then giving up is never a choice, no matter how long the odds. And to be honest, as an undeniable inheritance from an ornery, intractable grandfather, I'm just a little too obstinate to give up now.